Welcome to the Viet Cinema Canon with host Anderson Lay. This is a sub-series of the Vietnamese podcast. You know, Tony Bui is a director that started out in the mid-90s. And when I was a student at USC, I went to go see Three Seasons twice. And it really inspired me.
His first film, right?
His first film, yeah. It really inspired me to go into film. And many of us, I wasn't the only one. There's a lot of us that... And I understand that he is a sort of somebody who really understands film, I mean, inside and out. And you had a conversation with Tony. Can you tell me why you chose Tony?
Well, I mean, again, the whole subseries, the Viet Cinema Canon, what is that? We're exploring kind of what the filmmakers that helped shape this canon, basically our stories on on the big screen and movies and TV. And Tony is very much kind of like, he's the benchmark. He's basically the guy. He's who really opened up the floodgates, as especially in the 90s and whatnot. Very rare to see an Asian American director working. With Tony, wrote and directed Three Seasons, produced it with his brother Tony. Tim Bui, blew the doors open at Sundance. It got universal acclaim. Rarity to do the hat trick and won three awards.
Yeah, it really paved the way for all of us after.
Yeah, exactly. So that inspired us, it was like Gen X or millennials who want to work in film, right? So Tony was the guy.
Yeah.
And Tony now, has transitioned this. He still is a filmmaker, but transitioned to as an educator. Now he's at Columbia University teaching film, Asian film, Vietnamese film.
He doesn't give interviews. I mean, I've actually tried to get a few interviews with him a few times and things haven't worked out. So you beat me to the punch, but... Join the conversation with Andy and Tony.
Really stoked to interview my friend, Tony Bui. And before we start the conversation, I want to give a quick bio on Tony. Tony Bui is a Sundance award-winning writer, director, and producer. He is currently artist-in-residence at Columbia University in New York City at the Weatherhead East Asian Institute and teaches at the school's arts graduate film program. His films include Yellow Lotus, Three Seasons, Green Dragon, and The Throwaways. His short film Yellow Lotus was the first Vietnamese language film to be screened at the Sundance Film Festival and received over 15 national and international festival awards. His feature film debut, Three Seasons, was the first American-Vietnamese co-production to be filmed entirely in Vietnam. The film received the Grand Jury Prize, Audience Award, and Best Cinematography Award at the Sundance Film Festival, along with two Independent Spirit Award nominations. Three Seasons was also Vietnam's official entry to the Oscars, where it was shortlisted. In 2024... Three Seasons was brought back to Sundance and chosen as one of the 10 films from the festival's four-decade history to celebrate its 40th anniversary. Tony is a recipient of the Humanities Prize and an alumnus of the Sundance Institute's screenwriting and directing labs. He has written and developed projects for HBO, Warner Brothers, and NBC. Tony previously was on the board of directors for Film Independent for 7 years and is currently at the Global Advisory Board of Fulbright University in Vietnam. As artist in residence in Colombia, Tony has brought filmmakers, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists, global activists, and more to the campus as guest speakers to engage in vital conversations about the role of artists and truth seekers. So without further ado, let's have this conversation with Tony. Tony, how's it going, man?
It's great. Great. It's cold here in New York City. But I'm warm here, so that's good. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, man. Thanks for being a part of this conversation series. It's very exciting. Was the impetus, the idea behind this series was to talk to filmmakers, especially in this very landmark year of just 2025, the 50th anniversary of the end of the American War in Vietnam. I just wanted to just revisit especially in your role at Columbia, just especially I think one of your mandates is to bring more Vietnamese into the arts on campus and whatnot in general, especially with your speaker series around the world and what you do at Columbia, your role as an educator, and, you know, kind of like using kind of your film career as the syllabus, so to speak, in promoting that, right? So, you know, I think arts and culture is very important, especially when art is a reflective of the Vietnamese experience, you know, and I think it's a very important tenet. So basically, you know, why don't you start off with what you're growing up? I think you were born in Vietnam and then you emigrated to the U.S., right? So, and then, you know, just I think you grew up in Northern California, and then just as a kid, what inspired you to what were some of the films that you watched that inspired you and then kind of brought you along into making filmmaking your kind of your career, your call to work?
Yeah, so, you know, like you said, I was born in Saigon, came here when I was just a baby, but, you know, like many, you know, Vietnamese refugee stories, you know, we were spread out, you know, our family spread out different parts of the country. Our, you know, family ended up in Northern California, and both my parents ended up working in tech. And so the environment we grew up in my opinion, at least at the time, could not have been further away from anything to do with the arts, right? And especially, you know, the way my upbringing was, you know, you sort of, you know, the way it involved the community. So it was, a lot of it was around sort of anything had to do with computers, math, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, the people who were talked about in Legends were people like Steve Jobs and these guys, right? And Steve Jobs actually went to a high school, in third generation, of course, you know, near where I went to high school. But, you know, and growing up in a Vietnamese family, and at that time when we were growing up, there weren't a lot of Vietnamese families around us, right? I mean, obviously now San Jose is important center for Vietnamese Americans, but at that time, you know, we weren't living in San Jose at that time, and there just weren't a lot. And so, you know, it wasn't like I was around artists or filmmakers. I was not at all in the conversation. You know, it's something you don't even think about or dream of, because it's impossible for a young sort of Vietnamese American child to even think that that's a possibility. It's something, you know, you go to movies, watch it. It's so distant, right? It wasn't like I even grew up in LA or anything like that. So I do think about how this all happened, because it is, you know, in many ways, I feel like it was, you know, destiny in some ways, but I hate using that word, you know. But when I think back, it's hard to deny some of the moments for me, at least the way I see it. And one of them was just, you know, my dad was working for a company at that time called Memorex, you know, older people remember, you know, that company. Yeah. And he got laid off. And at that time, he was trying to figure out what to do. And it was during the time when, you know, so there were sort of these, you know, video, you know, rental stores started to take off. So he decided to open one. And then he and my mom opened up another one, then another one. And, you know, and it just took off. And at the height of it, I think they had like 5 video stores around Northern California. So, you know, my brother and sister and I, we had, you know, some like 10,000 movies, you know, at our disposal that we can watch at any time. You know, and we had to work at the video stores as well. So not only, you know, so here I am like at, you know, 14, 15 years old, you know, having to work at the video store. Basically catalog them, rent them out to the customers. And then, of course, you know, you're young, you're curious about them. And I mean, I spent all my time in the video stores and would bring them home, watch them. I didn't understand cinema at all. It wasn't like I was trying to seek out interesting films and filmmakers and all that. I was just absorbing a lot of films. So because of that, my early, you know, film education came from all the very commercial, you know, American Hollywood filmmakers like John Hughes. I watched all the John Hughes films, obviously, because I was young. So, you know, Breakfast Club and all those films, 16 Candles. Of course, you know, great ones like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, all that stuff. And then, you know, I remember the first time I didn't, you know, other than, of course, Bruce Lee movies or Jackie Chan, like the first time I saw like Asians on screen any kind of a cinematic way was when Last Emperor, you know, came about, Bertolucci's film. And heck, that won the Oscar. And I was like, what's the Oscar? You know, I remember seeing The Last Emperor in the movie theater. It was the first film that I actually stayed for the credits. You know, yeah. You know, when you're young, you watch, like, I don't care. Like, what, you know, other than, you know, I didn't even care who the director was. I cared even less. You know, what's a, you know, a key grip? You know, who's the cinematographer? Who's the best boy? What were these different positions? It didn't matter to me. I just remember there was, like, you know, 1,000 names that would follow a film. It would bore the hell out of me, and I would leave before that. The Last Emperor was the first one that I actually stayed for all the credits. And so I started getting curious, you know, what it takes to make a film. Who are the players? You know, who holds these sort of creative choices? Again, I didn't understand my cinematography, but I understood enough to know that The Last Emperor stood out, you know, the way he used his colors. At that time, I didn't know who Storaro was and who shot the film or anything like that. But, you know, but the use of visual language, something that really, you know, affected me. And it was like, but again, it was more just out of curiosity. Never, ever did I think it was something that that could be a viable career choice. And it wasn't until I took a media class in high school where I started making short films with, like, you know, those big video cameras that, you know, we had back in the day that my dad had. And I would edit by using two video decks, VCR decks, and just, like, record. And it was like super, you know, archaic, obviously, you know, analog. And but my friends and I were able to make these, like, you know, mini horror films. And I think that's when it wasn't that I thought I can do it, but it was more like the bug, you know, sort of, you know, was in me. And there's something that I couldn't shake. And I just found tremendous joy in being able to express myself in this medium. And the other thing I wanted to add is I was just really, I was definitely an introvert, a shy kid. You know, I was the president of my chess team. So I just told you everything, you know, where my social standing was in school. Uh-huh. You know, and but I was incredibly fascinated by this thing called cinema. And I just started watching a lot of it. And fortunately, because of my parents' video stores, I had access to just, you know, I mean, probably over 10,000-15,000 movies to watch. I started watching a whole lot more.
Yeah, the video stores, were they for the Vietnamese community, or is it like
No. We didn't have a single Vietnamese title in there. It was all for the American public.
Okay, yeah.
Santa Clara, Palo Alto,
got
Campbell.
It.
There was not a single, you know, and then we only wanted it in San Jose, but no, it was all American titles. So, you know, that was actually very, very, I mean, I don't think I saw a single Asian on screen.
It wasn't those Hong Kong dubbed, Vietnamese dubbed Hong Kong TVB dramas that you'd see in, like,
we didn't have
Condor Heroes or something like that, right? So it was
No, we didn't have those. You know, I know I speak to some, you know, Vietnamese today about you never saw those? And I was like, I never did. You know, we didn't have those in the home or at the video store. But, you know, I watched, other than Last Emperor, I remember when, oh my god, the one with Dennis Dunn and what's it called?
Big Trouble in Little China.
Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah.
Blew my mind. You know, obviously it was a fun film, but Dennis Dunn, I was like, oh my god, there's an Asian in an American movie. You know, and I love Dennis Dunn. I got to work with him later on, you know, which was a huge honor. But I love Dennis Dunn because of that, you know, and who's like a hero to me because you know, he was in Big Trouble in Little China.
Can I ask you something? What's your family's story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you, safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded.
Going back to, like, The Last Emperor, the first time, I mean, it must have been very impactful for you. Was that kind of your gateway drug? Like in the sense of like, wow, I'm seeing people who look like me on the big screen. And was that kind of like, okay, well, this is, was that your film that was like, okay, well, maybe I, you know, it kind of awoke in some kind of cinematic.
Absolutely. You know,
like, yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah.
I mean, that for me was definitely up there. Cause you know, I grew up in the 80s as well. That and, and Big Trouble Little China was definitely one, you know? Yeah. But, but go ahead.
Sorry. I mean, it was so bad when even in the, those early films in the '80s, when, what was it? Oh my God, I'm gonna mess up the name now. Who is the Asian character in all in like that one John Hughes movie? Yeah, you know, the Long Duk Dong or something like that.
Long Duk Dong, yeah. And Sixteen Candles.
Yeah, and everyone would make fun of him. And it was super embarrassing, of course, to be Asian and have that, right? Because then everyone makes fun of you and that. But I was still fascinated. I was like, oh my God, he was just like, you know, it's not even a real Asian character, but you know what I mean, you know. But I was, you know, and that's how bad the representation was for us. And and so that when, you know, a film like Last Emperor comes up, you know, it was all in English and all that, I was still mesmerized by that. It wasn't until I actually went to film school and started to watch, you know, films from obviously from China around the world that started to really, you know, affect me in a big way. And I started to realize not only that I love cinema, wanted to do this, but then I started to realize my purpose, you know, but that didn't come until later. I just was really just a kid fascinated by the ability to express oneself through cinema, through the visual and cinematic language. And you know, so I started seeking out what it meant to be a director and all that kind of stuff early on. But yeah, but it really came, you know, really that change, that shift was because of these video stores that my parents had.
So, you know, so you were making these kind of backyard home, you know, like little horror movies with your friends and whatnot. But how did that kind of transition when you were post high school going into university? What made you decide to basically, I mean, I assume you went to film school. I mean, you got a film degree. Yeah. What made you decide to go pursue that?
I mean, it wasn't easy. So,
versus like, you know, more of the practical thing of like accounting or tech or whatever. Like,
So, and because, you know, I did well in high school and, you know, aside from being the president of the chess team, I was also, you know, in the math club, the math competitions, and I was good at it. You know, very classic, so cliche Asian stuff.
Sure.
That was a thing, you know, so my parents obviously thought I was going to go into engineering or tech or medicine or something, you know, respectable like that. And I still recall when, you know, when I told my parents I wanted to study film, and it wasn't even like I knew that I wanted to be a filmmaker. I just want to be around that energy, right? Because there's no way a Vietnamese kid growing up in Northern California in the 80s, you know, can dream big enough to say that I want to be a film director one day, right? For me, it was just like, I want to be in that environment. I don't know what, you know, I mean, of course, in my heart, I want to do that, but it's one of those things where you're just unsure. But I wanted to go to film school and explore and be around that energy, right? And I told my parents, and I remember, like, they were incredibly unhappy about it. You know, my mom, you know, had a pretty much like a breakdown, and they did everything they could to try to convince me not to go down that path. Everything from one to send me to go visit my cousin, who was already a doctor at the time, to you know, basically, they thought it was a phase, and if I can just experience or be in contact with people who did really well in the fields that they wanted me to go into, that I would shake off this you know, this passing teenage obsession. But I didn't, to their disappointment. And I remember a car ride. This was a very important car ride. I remember my dad was, you know, stoic military man, did not, you know, wasn't the kind of person that would take you out and have long conversations with you. You know, he asked me to go for a car ride, and I was like 16 or 17 years old or something. And just that alone freaked me out, because he would never do that. I said, you know, where we're going, he's like, it didn't matter. Just drive north towards San Francisco, which is very scary. I knew it was going to be a difficult conversation. So, and I had to do the driving. So he sat in the passenger seat and he just started asking me all these questions, like, why do you want to go to film school? You know, what if you don't make it? The chance of making it is very, it's gonna be very slim. And I remember just answering all the questions, but, you know, it's passion, love. I feel being drawn to this. And I remember, you know, he's like, you're not going to make any money. And I said, you know, it didn't matter. So I'm not doing this for the money. And I remember saying, you know, even if I'm broke and I'm poor, but I'm doing what I love, and that's what only that matters to me. And I remember him saying this, you know, and he goes, you know, can you point to one Vietnamese person that has made films and made it in America, you know, as a filmmaker? And I could not, you know, in a sense, you know, sort of my generation, we were going to be the first to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And I could not. And he said, okay, can you point to, you know, one non-Vietnamese, any Asian that you know comes from our regional area who's gone out to make a film and has made it in Hollywood? And I just could not, you know? And even the film that influenced me, you know, that Thousand Age film was made by an Italian director, okay. You know, Bernardo Bertolucci, right? So I could not. And then he's like, okay, can you just point to not one Vietnamese, not one Asian, you can point to just one American, any white American that you know of in that region? I'm sure there was, but I didn't know anybody. I could not point to anyone. Of course, you know, Lucas came from there, but I didn't know, you know, like, you know, so I was like, I cannot. He was like, point to any one person, you know, that you know of or heard of who came from the Bay Area, anything. I could not. So basically, I could not point to a single person. So he says, then why do you think you can make it? You know? And so I just had to answer that, you know, I don't know if I can make it, but I know it's something that's in my heart, that something that I didn't know at that point, the passion was so great in me that I didn't know how to live without it. And that's what I expressed to my dad. And so it wasn't about trying to make it or make money. I didn't know what making it even meant, but I just knew it was something that I had to do. And it was a form of expression that I wanted to be a part of. And I remember he got really quiet. He was like, okay, I've heard enough. Turn the car around. Let's try it back. He didn't say a single word on the way back. It was absolutely silent. But I knew I got him, and he allowed me to go to film school, and he was okay with it. But that was him. And he got home, and clearly it was a conversation that my mom probably made him go do, and he did not succeed in convincing me not to go to film school. Uh-huh. So I could imagine what my mom probably said to him when he got back, and it was like, oh, you know, let's let him do this. You know, he convinced me. My mom was like, you had one job. One job, you failed at it, you know. So my mom, for the next like 2-3 years, continued to try to convince me to stop going to film school. And I remember, like, I was a junior. She was like, if you wanted to, you know, go back to engineering school, you can. And we would, you know, pay for it all over again. Just don't go to study film. And I say go back to engineering school because one of the things I did was I tried to make it unclear whether I was going to film school at the start. And I said, well, you know, maybe I'll go, but I'll study engineering. You know, but they were so busy with their business and work, they never actually followed, paid attention to what I was doing. But sure. I was actually just going to film school, even though I was, you know, alluding to the fact that I might have been going to engineering school, you know. So that's how it started. But when I got to film school, you know, I know there's a lot of debate whether film school is necessary or not. And every individual is different. Their background and trajectory is different. For me, it was an absolutely game-changing moment in my life. And in the time I was in film school, for me, it was like an oasis. You know, I got to, oh, by the way, it wasn't just my parents. Everyone in my life told me not to do it. My high school friends, my high school counselor said it was the worst mistake of my life. Cause he was like, oh, you're doing well in school. You should, you know, and all my friends and I'm going to like, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area. So my friends all went to like Berkeley or Stanford or other schools. And they went to technology and all that. Every single person in my life said it was a mistake. I honestly can't pinpoint one person who thought it was a good idea to leave and go to film school. And when I went, I was the only Vietnamese kid in there. And later on there was, you know, another one came, you know, some others came, but at that time there was no one. But it was an absolute dream, an amazing time period of my life to go to film school, because basically all I did 24/7 was eat, drink, you know, sleep, film, you know, I watched it. We obviously had to study it. And then I took a job as a projectionist. And that was a game changer for me. And so I lived out my own cinema paradiso, you know? And I basically was this kid. Not only did I study these films, I had to project them for all the other classes as well. So all the great, you know, European classics, I got to, you know, the Italian neorealists, the French New Wave, you know, the Chinese fifth generation filmmakers. Not only did I get to study these films, I had to project them over and over and over again for other classes. I had to watch like these films multiple times, you know, throughout the semester. And it was absolutely the most beautiful, amazing time period of my life. And I have to say, for, you know, for the younger generation who might be watching this, I projected them all on celluloid, which was like amazing. So they were coming in reels, big canisters. Sure. I had to like clean them, put the little dots on them for the gate. You know, we do this thing called the changeover, which no one, you know, most people who watch this, unless you're projections, probably won't understand. And then, and then we would have to thread them. And then once they were done, clean them, put them all back in the canisters, ship them back. So it, but you know, but as you know, but when you're like 18, 19, 20 and all that, it was, you know, I basically lived in the projection booth when I wasn't in class or working on film sets.
Well, I think it's like, you know, I think back, you know, back in like, you know, 80s and 90s, you know, going to film school, being a projectionist, like just being in cinema in general, like it's like, you know, the entry point was like more difficult because it's, you know, because it's on celluloid right now, it's like analog. Now, you know, like anyone can be technically making movies on their iPhone, you know, like it's like completely changed, you know? So I think there's a romanticism in film. And I think, you know, that that's kind of lost in the kind of like the whole, and then at the same time, it's in the whole, you know, digital revolution, but you know, at the same time, it's leveled the playing field, so to speak, but you know, there's good and bad things about it. But anyway, so like, you know, going to film school, whatnot, Yellow Lotus was it your graduate?
I went to film school as an undergrad, so it was my undergraduate thesis to graduate.
Undergraduate thesis, Vietnamese story, but you didn't film it in Vietnam, right? You filmed it.
Yellow Lotus, the whole thing.
Oh, no, you said, you're right, you did film it in Vietnam. That's right. Yeah. That's right. So Yellow Lotus in Three Seasons. It was a short film and then your feature film. Both filmed in Vietnam. They're Vietnamese stories. I mean, you're basically the first American production back in Vietnam, you know, after the war. Maybe briefly just talk about that, those experiences of going. I mean, was it a lot of escape? Was it a lot of like, how did you kind of like convince, say, the government to allow you to go shoot in Vietnam, employ Vietnamese, you know, cast and crew and whatnot?
Absolutely. To make sense of that, I'm going to backtrack like 1 or 2 years real quick, and I'll answer a previous question you had. So I, even though I was born in Vietnam, I'd never been, you know, but I was left when I was so young that I had no memory of being there. Yeah. Right? My earliest memories are in America. And I was already in film school when I went to Vietnam for the first time at the age of 19. So I went with my dad, and it was one of those things where I was curious about the country, but I wasn't sure if I really wanted to go. But obviously I was like, okay, I'll go. And I remember so clearly when the plane landed, and at that time when the plane lands, everyone would clap, right? Because it was just one of those like emotional things, you know, so many Vietnamese were coming back to Vietnam at that time in the 90s. I remember like the cabin doors opening and all this humidity and heat hit me. And I was already like, oh, this is going to be awful. I remember thinking very clearly, if I had a magic button, I would press and go right back to California. Because I was like that, you know, we grew up in the suburbs of California you know, obviously, you know, did not experience any of this. I was basically, you know,
cool weather, dry weather, like in Northern California. Yeah.
So and then we go and I get to see my grandparents and uncles and cousins, and all that, you know, for the first time. And it was, you know, it wasn't a immediately emotional experience. It wasn't like, oh my God, you know, it was almost like an awkward experience. I didn't really know them, and obviously Vietnam that time in the mid 90s was, you know, was underdeveloped because of so many, you know, decades of war, and it was a difficult place to be. I remember being bitten by mosquitoes all the time and just being having, you know, a lot of problems because, you know, not familiar with the food and just having a lot of health issues and all that. And I remember just not really liking it, right? And at one point I asked my dad, I can just cut this. It was only a 2-week trip. I can cut it short and go back. And he's like, no, you can't do that. You end up putting me, I was staying at my grandmother's house. I just felt so uncomfortable. And my guy ended up putting me in a hotel, which made it a little better. But by the time I left, you know, I was ready to leave. But something happened. And this was another turning point that really changed my life. I remember when I was about to leave, I started to cry. I didn't understand why. because the entire 2 weeks I was miserable. You know, I just wanted to leave. I want to go back to California. You know, I was like, this is not for me and all that kind of stuff. But I started to cry. And the whole plane trip home, I felt this incredibly, you know, I felt this emptiness start to form. And I didn't understand why, but clearly something was connecting me with the country and the people, you know, even in a subconscious way. And after that trip, I started to seek out everything I could about Vietnam. Hmm. And I would watch videotapes and documentaries, and it would change the books I would read, the films I would watch. And then, the next opportunity I got to go back, I took it right away. And this time I would start going, visiting the bookstores and the libraries, and this something happened. And I know, you know, thinking back, I know more clearly now, but that time I didn't. And this is why I believe in the importance of representation so much, is that going into the bookstore, I saw every face in the magazine, the books looked Vietnamese. And that's something that I never experienced in America, right? If you're a child growing in America, you look different, and you go in and you go into, you know, a bookstore, you know, and the magazine rack is basically all white faces, or, you know, occasional sort of African-American face or Latino face, but you'll never see an Asian face, right? Except for one or the other person that had an impact when I was young. Was the character in, oh my God. I don't know why I'm blanking right now. Indiana Jones.
Oh yeah. Ki-Hui Kwan, Short Round.
Yeah. Ki-Hui Kwan. Yeah. And, you know, just seeing, you know, him on there was, you know, and then at one point he was on the front page of Tiger Beat or something like that. And it blew my mind. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. You know, only an Asian, but you know, he was, you know, also a refugee from Vietnam. It was such a, you know, but being in Vietnam and driving, you know, going down the street and seeing every face on the billboards be Vietnamese, and seeing all the magazines have Vietnamese faces, and you know, on television, all Vietnamese faces, you know, it had this tremendous effect on me. It confused me because I did not grow up like that. And, you know, I wasn't one of those kids growing up, you know, thinking, oh, you know, there isn't a Vietnamese face on these American, you know, these American magazines. Something is really wrong. I just accepted it as the norm. But I realized that wasn't the norm, at least for, you know, in every part of the world. And in Vietnam, the norm is to have people look like me on there. And it was such an aha moment, a moment of clarity for me. And so when I went go back to college, it changed everything for me. And it changed the directory of the kind of films I want to make as well. So Yellow Lotus is born out of that. So, because when I went to film school, I thought I was going to be making, honestly, you know, like other kinds of movies. And I wasn't interested in telling the Vietnamese experience or Vietnamese American experience at all. I didn't even know that you can express that, you know?
Yeah.
And these trips in Vietnam changed that. And so Yellow Lotus was born out of that. And also, just add one thing, in the mid-90s was a period of Doi Mai. And so basically, yeah, Vietnam and America started to reconcile, and diplomatic relations were renewed by, you know, President Clinton at the time, 1995. So, and we opened up our, you know, embassy again. And so there was this huge change socially and economically in Vietnam. And I happened to experience that firsthand. And Yellow Lotus, you know, was a film about that change through the eyes of the Vietnamese people. And that became the precursor to Three Seasons.
Yeah, Three Seasons, I call like it did the unprecedented hat trick at Sundance, where it won three awards, you know, like this was 1999, I think.
Yeah.
Sundance 99. Yeah. So, you know, the Grand Jury Prize, the Audience Award, and Best Cinematography, right? So, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, yeah, the fact that you did this, and, you know, it was a desert when it comes to Asian representation, you know, in films, you know, like, just like really quickly that experience, this is kind of like in the heyday of Sundance, you know, when, especially in the 90s, when there was like this boom of like the independent film scene, and Sundance was getting all this recognition from, like, you know, the, you know, think of Soderbergh's and the Tarantino's and the Robert Rodriguez and, you know, Alison Anders and all, and et cetera, right? So, talk about kind of like just that experience really quickly.
It was, you know, obviously a very emotional experience. You know, we, you know, so I just want to add in there real quick that my brother, Timothy Bowie, also worked on Yellow Lotus with me. So when we went to Sundance, and he worked on 3 seasons with me. In fact, when he worked on Yellow Lotus, it was actually his first time back to Vietnam. Like I had gone, you know, several times already.
Right.
And he was maybe more hesitant to me than me to go. But when I finally made Yellow Lotus, he came back to help me produce that. And I just asked, answer your question earlier about difficulty of getting, you know, the government approval. It was difficult. At that time, the infrastructure to make films was still, you know, very minimal at the time. And so basically, I brought my crew from America. Even on my short film Yellow Lotus, I brought a lot of students from my film school, and I brought someone who later on would make his films. I want to give a shout out to, you know, because of the there's an emotional connection for a lot of us Vietnamese American. That's Stefan, you know Gogger, and he, you know, he you know, I remember connecting with them, and when I made Yellow Lotus, I was like 20 years old, and he was like maybe 23, and he came in and worked as my gaffer. And, you know, so those early members were very special. And Stefan obviously went out to make, you know, a lot of special films in Vietnam. And I mentioned that because, you know,
all in the Sparrow, especially, you know, so.
Yeah.
But rest in peace, Stefan. So.
Exactly. So Stefan was part of that original, you know, crew, that made, you know, the Lotus with us. And we all went to Sundance together, and it was very special, you know, again. You know, there's not a single other Vietnamese person. There's very few Asians at the time. I remember, and I said this in other interviews and stuff, but, like, you know, it was so rare to see an Asian at Sundance at the time that if you were to see one at a park or across the street, you would, like, oh my God, like, gravitate towards each other and talk and, like, oh my God, there's another Asian. Can't believe it, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, we come a long way, thankfully. And, but it took a long time to come this far. But anyway, so, you know, so getting approval in Vietnam was difficult. You know, if you want to shoot in Vietnam, you have to go through, you know, many different steps, the Bureau of Cinema, Ministry of Culture, and go up and get approval, you know, from the government. And then there's a censor officer with you on set at all times. So when you shoot, make sure you stick to the script, only the script, you know. So it was difficult, but we did it. And something that we were, it wasn't one of those things where we thought like we were trailblazing and everything like that. It was just, you know, making films so tough, and at that time you're so young, you just, you know, I just had a really passionate story that I wanted to tell about Vietnam at that time period, and wanted to represent the Vietnamese people in a way that I thought had not been represented in film and media at that time, and still, you know, rarely, you know, in a way that was rarely done. And and when you asked me about shooting in Vietnam, I want to make a point about that. I don't want to skip over that quickly because that was an important criteria for me. So when I made Yellow Lotus and 3 Seasons, there were 3 things I really wanted to make sure would happen because I had watched so many films about Vietnam, you know, these American war films, Apocalypse Now, Platoon, all these other films, you know, and none of them shot on the actual soil of Vietnam.
Right.
And a lot of them, you know, used Thai actors, Filipino actors, and basically said they were Vietnamese and pretended to speak Vietnamese. It was basically just gibberish.
Yeah,
but they pretended to speak Vietnamese, and I'm sure the producers were like, "Oh, it's good enough, you know," and so long as it sounds Asian, you know, no one cares. That kind of stuff, right? So when I set out to do Yellow Lotus in 3 Seasons, it was important to me to shoot on the actual soil of Vietnam, right? So both films entirely shot in Vietnam.
In honor of Military Appreciation Month, Verizon thought of a lot of different ways we could show our appreciation, like rolling out the red carpet, giving you your own personal marching band, or throwing a bumping shindig. At Verizon, we're doing all that in the form of special military offers. That's why, this month only, we're giving military and veteran families a $200 Verizon gift card and a phone on us, with a select trade-in and a new line on select unlimited plans. Think of it as our way of flying a squadron of jets overhead while launching fireworks. Now that's what we call a celebration, because we're proud to serve you. Visit your local Verizon store to learn more. $200 Verizon gift card requires smartphone purchase, $799.99 or more with new line on eligible plan. Gift card sent within 8 weeks after receipt of claim. Phone offer requires $799.99 purchase with new smartphone line on Unlimited Ultimate or Postpaid Unlimited Plus. Minimum plan $80 a month with autopay plus taxes and fees for 36 months. Less $800 trade-in or promo credit applied over 36 months. 0% APR. Trade-in must be from Apple, Google, or Samsung. Trade-in and additional terms apply.
So Vietnamese people, Vietnamese actors, and that was very important for me. And then third, to have real Vietnamese dialogue, to have real Vietnamese spoken in these films and not just, you know, pretend Vietnamese or words or sounds somewhat Vietnamese phonetically, but weren't really Vietnamese, that kind of stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. So anyways, that was important for me at that time, even back when I was making Yellow Lotus.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, Three Seasons, again, you know, just such, made such a impact at Sundance, and it's you know, pretty much hallowed in Sundance history. But, you know, this was like, you know, kind of before, a few years before Better Luck Tomorrow with Justin Lin, before, you know, now you see this, like, you know, before even Crazy Rich Asians, before, you know, now you see, you know, Shang-Chi or whatever, like, you know, you see now more representation. Ki Huy Quan coming back to into the fold with Everything Everywhere All at Once and winning an Oscar, you know? So, yeah. And so, you know, they could, and that's like fast forward like 20 plus years now. You know, just like with Three Seasons, you know, I mean, Sundance brought it back, and like, and you meticulously went through kind of like the restoration process of, you know, just basically just updating the film look into this 4K restoration, and now it's been, you know, again bringing back Sundance. It's played at various film festivals and cinematheques around the world. You know, people are rediscovering Three Seasons, and you know, which is fantastic. And then now, you know, kind of your role now as a artist in residence at the, you know, Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia. You know, like now, and just what I mean, you know, just like your work there, as essentially an educator, how do you see now, such, I'm sure that your student body, there's a lot of students of Asian descent, you know, and also non-Asian descent, obviously. And then how are you, you know, your curriculum of, you know, Three Seasons, your work with Three Seasons and all your other work, but also with kind of like Asian global cinema, what is their kind of reaction when it comes to, I think these are Gen Z students, right? So what do you think, how they are consuming or learning about kind of Asian cinema versus you as a, you know, Gen Xer, millennial back in the day, and what their reactions were, their reactions were, you know, back in the 90s and early 2000s when it comes to consuming.
There's a lot to say with all that. I'll rewind real quick as you talk about, Three Seasons at Sundance. I'll start there because I didn't really fully answer that question for you earlier. It's just, you know, we obviously made the film. It was film with a passion. It was a story that was important, you know, for me to tell about what was going on in Vietnam at that time period. It was a film that were the heroes of the story were people who were most often overlooked in Vietnam, and right, in the newspapers, weren't, you know, covered in most of the conversations at that time. Vietnam was going through this huge change, again, I said, because of the, you know, Doi Mai and sort of the you know, American Vietnam coming back together again, and economically and diplomatically, and a lot of the winners of the stories were obviously the politician, the businessmen, people who, you know, the movers and shakers, decision makers. And but the time that I spent in Vietnam, I spent a lot of time with the people who were affected by these decisions, but were not the people had much of a say in it. So anyway, so Three Seasons was a representation of these people, and you know, and there's sort of some lyricism in it, and sort of it's a metaphor to some other things, you know, that's going on in the country at that time. So that was important to me. But of course, in America, you know, we come there, and you know, it. We had no expectation at Sundance because, you know, at that, a film like that is rare. You know, was never, a film like that was never seen at Sundance. So when it won those awards, it was such a, it obviously was an emotional and beautiful moment, but it was so overwhelming and confusing that I remember just thinking back at that time, I don't think there was much joy. It was just more like confusion. And then that was really sick because it was Sundance, and you always get sick when you go there. But also a feeling of responsibility of, okay, this had to happen for a reason, and how do I take this and move it forward in a way that allows for more films like this to get made? And sometimes I say, you know, it's a film that won its awards at the wrong time, because that time in 1999, I remember after making this film, trying to go out and make more films like that. And every single studio that I met and every single meeting I had with producers were like, oh, that was an experiment that worked. We don't want to do something like that again. And every script I got was basically, you know, stories of, you know, where there was a single Asian in there, not even Vietnamese, there was a single Asian in the story. It was basically just basically, you know, all the heroes and protagonists and all the characters were all basically white, you know? And they basically were sending me these scripts and saying, you know, we took a chance on your one Vietnamese film. It made money, thankfully, it won awards, but you know, you have this ability, let's make films that people actually want to see. You know what I mean? So, yeah. You know, so it was a very difficult journey in, you know, at the start. And like you said earlier, Bad Luck Tomorrow didn't come to a few years later. And then the big wave of Asian cinema didn't come to like 20 years later. So literally every single meeting, they did not want to duplicate anything that we tried to do with Three Seasons. So it was really, you know, odd and difficult journey. So there was this high, this immediate low, because you realize the reality of the situation, that, you know, they basically said this was a one-off, now go do something else, you know? So you know, we had to deal with that. So because of that, the film, when it came out, was shown on celluloid, right? It was shot in 35 millimeter, it was projected in the theaters on celluloid. But because of you know, this, you know, because it came just, you know, a couple years before the switch to digital.
The film,
you know, never was remastered into, you know, a digital format. It was never transferred. So it basically just existed in celluloid for the next 20 years. And eventually, you know, streaming came, and the film, if it would need to be shown, had to be projected. So yeah. The chance for it to,
I mean, there's also rights issues and whatnot, you know, companies coming and going.
Yeah. So it existed only on celluloid and eventually disappeared.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the film could not be streamed or seen anywhere. Everyone would ask me, well, how do I see the film? And I was like, you really could not. Except for, you know, like there was a couple of DVDs made. I think one, you know, I think it was basically a company out of Korea. We had no oversight into that. I think the rights were sold. Someone made a really bad, you know, DVD copy. And that was what was sold on Amazon. And that's what, you know, most, you know, educators and libraries use to need to see the, you know, teach the film or show the film. But I have a copy of it. And, you know, it's a really bad transfer. And the subtitles aren't even correct. You know, it's all these mistakes in the subtitles. But again, you know, they, you know, because there was also Korean subtitles in there as well, but it was originally made for Korean audience, you know, made for Korean audience. So that was the best we can get. And then someone had uploaded a version of that to YouTube. So some scratch, really bad version. That's the only way to watch the film, you know, until last year. And just to talk about the restoration, you know, I was very fortunate that, you know, Sundance had their 40th anniversary and selected 10 films to represent the 40 years, and Three Seasons got picked as one of them. So because it was called back, but there was no way to show it. And John Nine at Sundance is basically like, the film has to be, you know, there has to be a digital version for us to show it, because times have changed. You can't project a 35 millimeter print. And we had prints of it, of course.
Right.
So then it was a mad rush to make that happen. And Jason Cleo, and, you know, was one of the producers on it, and Joanna Vicente as well. But Jason Cleo worked with me to now restore the film. And we had a very short amount of time to do this. But basically, we had to raise the money and make it all happen. And basically, Sundance was like, if you can't hit these benchmarks along the way, we're going to have to drop it, because we can't announce it and not be at Sundance, right?
Yeah.
And I can say this now. Jason and I would every step of the way would tell Sundance, of course we can get it done. No, it's all set. No, we have the financing. Everything is there. We did not, you know, but we just believed that we could. But we had to. It's one of those things where we believed it would happen, and then move forward as it would, and just hope that everything would fall into place. And the film, you know, and it was very, very difficult. And I want to give a quick shout out to some people, because without them, it could not have happened. One of them was Professor Lin Hung at the Weatherhead Institute. She stepped in to help with the financing for the restoration. including a Columbia alumni named Peter Mack, who's an amazing individual. And he stepped in, and then we were able to they helped me write a letter, and then it was sent out to a bunch of different donors, and we were able to raise the money to get the financing of the restoration done. And the money wasn't even raised until December. You know, the Festival of Sundance is in January. So work already started, you know, and we did not know how we were going to fund this. And you know, and thankfully the labs, you know, did it, you know, because they knew the film. Some of them had already watched the film and really, you know, and were fans of the film. So they did it believing that we could find the money, right? And because, yeah. You know, and it was already word that Sundance wanted to program it. And I think John and I spoke to the lab and all that. So they knew it was, at least they felt like we were good for it. So they started the process. We had no idea because we told everyone, oh, yeah, the money's coming. We did not get the money until mid-December. It was incredibly, there was a lot of sleepless nights, you know.
Yeah, down to the wire. Yeah.
It was down to the wire. And we did not finish the film until, I think, 5 days before the festival started. Of course, crazy. You know, but it was absolutely crazy. And, but we got it done. And because we got it done, the film was restored to 4K. And so basically the restoration process is, you know, oh, one more thing. I have to add this. Because it was such a long period of time in which no one had actually went to go, you know, basically find and see the negative, that when this process started, we had to find the negative, find the sound elements to make sure they were of decent enough quality that it can even be restored in time because we had such a short right. amount of time. We basically did something that would take 6 months in like 6 weeks, basically, you know,
yeah.
that in the beginning, we couldn't even find the materials, you know, and there was this whole thing where we weren't sure where the negative was, and weren't sure where the sound elements, you know, were located. And we were extremely nervous, and I was like, "How in the world did you lose negative to my film?" You know, the labs. And eventually, it was found, but it took several weeks, and it was just basically mislabeled, you know. But eventually, found, and the process was able to start. And we did. It was just, it was a very nerve-wracking, but also very important process because one, obviously, I got to remaster my film. Now it exists in 4K. Now it was able to play at Sundance. And like you said, I had an amazing run in 2024. I played the Lincoln Center, Smithsonian, a bunch of different festivals. And I played all over the world, actually, and still continues to play. You know, it'll be many different schools. It's playing at NYU Tisch, actually, this coming Friday. I don't know when this comes out. Probably this podcast will come
later,
out
but it's, yeah. later. Already.
Yeah, but it comes out at Tisch. It'll play at Princeton. It's going to play at Asia Side of New York City. So it's still having its run, which is pretty amazing. And, you know, people are still reaching out. But I can only do this now because we have this 4K restoration, which,
right.
you know, yeah. which didn't exist before.
Versus, you know, showing the kind of like badly transferred Korean DVD. Like it's like.
Exactly. And that's how schools did it before, you sure. know, or they would yeah. show it because, you know, because now it's really hard to project 35 millimeter prints, you know.
It is, and, yeah.
Yeah. But it also made me aware of the importance of the restoration process.
Absolutely.
Preserving films and preserving our identity and our stories. And in the end, that's what this is. This isn't actually about preserving films. This is about preserving our stories. And that's why these films, whether it's mine or anyone else's, it's important not only in the preservation part of it, but we also have to make sure the next generation of storytellers and filmmakers get a chance to even tell these stories in the first place so that they can be preserved. And that's really important. And then that I'll put it to my time at Columbia. And that's why, you know, I decided to step into the World of Academia and accept this position to be artist in residence is to bring all this knowledge and experience that I have and basically help the next generation of storytellers and bring more of these stories to Columbia and other schools in a way that wasn't there when I was in film school and when I was going through college.
I mean, like, you know, I mean, just like looking back, like, you know, like, you know, university for you was so formative when you're watching, you know, like basically, you know, just, you know, like works from Zhang Yimou or Wong Kar-wai or you name it, or Akira Kurosawa, you know, like, how is it now as you looking, teaching, basically kids, well, you know, you know, young students in their 20s who are of, you know, who look like you and me, you know, of Asian descent, and kind of like, how do you see the way they are watching or consuming films differently?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. First, you know, access, right? When I watched all those, you know, films from Asia at the time, when I was in film school, we had to watch it as prints, right?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, there was like, you know, some like VHS. I remember like going to like the video store, you know, at that time I was in LA. So there's, you know, art house video stores you can go to and get some of these, you watch it that way as well.
Sure.
Otherwise it's prints or VHS. And then of course DVDs would come. And at that time there was no streaming yet. So the accessibility of it, you know, access is everything, right? If you don't have access to something, it doesn't matter if the content's out there, you can't even watch it, right? So representation is important. You got to get it made first. But then access is important, right? So both are important. And so where it's changed is the access to this content, to these films, to these stories, it's more widely available. So a lot of the kids now growing up who love cinema or Asian descent, they can watch all these films. And is, you know, now you can just press a couple of buttons on your computer and just have it streamed by your computer, you know, watch it. I hope they're not watching their computers. I hope they're watching it on some big screen at their homes, sure, at least on their big TV sets.
Yeah,
but you know what I mean. And but you know, so I think their connection to these stories are different. We still have a long ways to go. So I don't think anyone is saying, oh, there's you know, we have amazing representation and we don't have to worry about it and all that. I think the need for representation and for Vietnamese storytelling, absolutely, Asian storytelling, of course, Asian American storytelling is still there. But it's different in that I think kids today have others to look to be able to say that, oh, this is possible, you know, that we can do this as a career, and that oh, we want to be like that person, make films like, you know, make these kinds of films. And I think that gap has diminished greatly, and the leap from being an engineer or a medical student, or, you know, as most Asians are pushed into, to becoming an artist, that leap is getting smaller and smaller, and that's a good thing.
Well, like, you know, one of the reasons the inspiration for this talking, you know, for this series, is, you know, basically just to reflect, because this year 2025 is you know, an anniversary year. It's the 50th anniversary of the, you know, the end of the Vietnam War, essentially. It's you know, like, you know, so just wanted to, and then kind of folds into your work at Columbia, you know, and what you're doing, especially for this year, you know, and maybe talk about kind of your goals personally to see more, not only Asian, but Vietnamese representation in the arts, and bringing them on campus, but also what your kind of the special project you're personally working on at Columbia, you know, with your, I think the, is it the 50-30 thing?
Yeah.
Also what you're doing, what you're kind of curating for Criterion Channel. So,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I just want to add one thing real quick, because as I'm saying all this stuff, I don't want to, because Hallie, I'm just throwing my mom under the bus, because all that early conflict with her actually helped me, because it forced me to really understand why I wanted to be a filmmaker, right? Sometimes when I had to really fight for it at every single stage, every level. And at that time, I was so bitter about it that I realized that it forced me to be better storyteller, better filmmaker, better artist, because it made me really in tune with what I wanted. When you have to fight for something, it sharpens you and sharpens that journey, and it helps solidify that purpose more. I don't think I would have been the same artist if the obstacles were not there. I'm not saying it should always be there, but I just want to put that out there. And the funny thing is, obviously, later on, when my mom realized that, you know, I can make a living out of it, and that's something that, you know, I gained success with. Even Yellow Lotus winning a lot of awards, and Sundance and onward, my mom, you know, became accepting of it. And then the true full circle moment was when my mom one day called me, and she was like, oh, by the way, I was thinking about being a screenwriter, you know, kid, and I had this idea for a screenplay, and I want to write a screenplay. if I write a screenplay, will you read it? I thought it was just such a funny moment from her not wanting to be a filmmaker to then that her wanting to be a screenwriter and make films herself. So it's such a classic moment. And
that comes full circle because, like, you know, she didn't see films a reflection of her or the movie's exactly. experience and whatnot, and maybe the fact that her son is making these films that are winning awards and whatnot. So that kind of sparked that. It's just like, you know, just you have to wrap your brain around things. Like, you know, like it's like you don't see it in front of you, you can't fathom it, you know? Like it's like
exactly. Yeah. So you know, it basically she went from seeing something as an impossibility to seeing that it's possible. And that's her arc through this, right? And that's it. So that's why I don't blame her. At that time when you're young, of course, you're really angry. She's like, you don't understand me and all that stuff that teenagers do and all that. But obviously, it's just that she grew up in during wartime, lost everything, was a refugee, came and had to rebuild everything. So for her, it's all about safety, about, you know, making sure you do things that, you know, that makes things possible for you in a way that she did not have, right?
Yeah, so that's something that's risk averse, you know? Yeah, risk averse and all that stuff. Yeah, so
exactly. But that's why, again, representation is important, right? She saw me go through this, and now she thought this thing, again, that was impossible to do is possible, and she changed her mind simply because you're able to see someone else do it, right? And you're able to see someone, that representation. So anyway, that's why it's important. You don't know who you're affecting, but there's always someone who's going to be watching quietly whose lives would, you know, his life would be changed because of their representation. That's why it's important. Okay. So get to about Columbia. So it's been an amazing journey. I had been invited to be at Columbia in earlier years. And I always thought, oh, it's not something I want to do. I want to just be an artist, make films and all that. But this opportunity came not only to teach, but also to be an artist in residence. So I thought, you know, I could have more impact, and it was a great combination. So I'm artist in residence at the Weathernet Institute, and also the institute, which has been around at Columbia for 75 years, and is to promote a better understanding with East Asia. Mm-hmm. And it came after World War II, and people not understanding that much about China and Japan. So Columbia, you know, with some funding, created this institute at that time to really focus on creating scholars who would be able to better advise policy and other educators about this region of the world. But it focused mostly on China, Japan, obviously, because, you know, the Cold War, and those are the major players at the time. And then later on, of course, Taiwan, Korea, of course, and by the 1950s and all that. But Southeast Asia was left out of it for decades until very recently. And Professor Lin Hong is actually the first director of the Institute of Southeast Asian Descent, and obviously the first Vietnamese. So that made a difference for me coming there as well. So I work at the Institute, and we try to do, and pretty much everyone at the Institute is in other fields, of course, in a lot of the history, economics and all that. And I'm the artist in residence there. So I try to bring a lot of artists and thinkers and creators to Columbia to speak from the vantage point of either Asians or Asian Americans. And we do a lot of work in Asia as well. So, you know, because I'm a filmmaker, so my focus is storytelling. And so we, you know, try to connect with and a lot of storytellers and filmmakers across Asia, and through programming, through talks, by bringing authors to Columbia for talks, or us going out and reaching out to and supporting artists in other countries. And then also I teach at Columbia, and I teach filmmaking in the grad program, and I try to focus my teaching along these lines as well. So I teach a class called International Filmmaking. We look at, you know, why films that are regionally made, and so we examine how they can maintain their authenticity regionally, we still have a global impact. Sure. And we look at a lot of films, you know, and so a lot of my students are grad students who are preparing to make their films and shoot overseas as well. Sure. And I teach another class called the Vietnam War in cinema. This is a class that means a lot to me, and it's a look at the Vietnam War through American cinema and Vietnamese cinema. And this is where it gets, you know, the Vietnamese cinema part is where it's different, because of course the American cinema part is well known in America. We all know films like Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now, and Platoon, and Full Metal Jacket, and all that. But I realized a lot of how Americans think about Vietnam was shaped by these films. No mm-hmm. one's ever seen the films from the Vietnamese side. You know, how do the Vietnamese portray themselves in this war? Obviously, here we call it the Vietnam War. In Vietnam, they call it the American War, right? So that was really fascinating to me. So I teach that class, and so I pair up these films based on themes, and we discuss these things. And it's always a, you know, I always get such amazing conversations from the students from this. So I do that, so and I joined Columbia and Weatherhead as artists in residence at a very unique time, because as you mentioned earlier, this year is the 50-30 means 50th anniversary of the end of the war and 30th anniversary of reconciliation, which is 1995, right? When I was saying earlier with America and Vietnam renewing their diplomatic ties. So it's a celebration of both. And so there's a lot of, you know, and Columbia has, you know, the largest sort of Vietnam studies program of any college in America. And we have several Vietnamese PhDs here in history, and which is amazing. And so we have a lot of programming that we're doing to commemorate those two milestones. And from a historical perspective to political perspective, and what I'm doing for these events is trying to bring an arts and culture perspective, and to see where we're at now, 50 years later, since the end of the war, and 30 years later since the since reconciliation. So this is important, and it's important because we're obviously a place of higher learning, and so we try to create conversations that have not only impact for our students, but have national and international impact as well. So we have a lot of very interesting people coming to have these conversations. And we've done a little bit of this throughout the last year and a half that I've been, you know, artist in residence, where we will have these thinkers and scholars come and give talks. So we're building up to our 50-30. And of course, my whole thing, again, is storytelling and film. So that's I take it from that perspective. Which I think a lot of times people think, oh, it's film, it's not as important. I think it's incredibly important. You know, you're in this field, Anderson, so you know, because you know, whether you're as artists, what do? We are, you know, basically collecting, you know, the stories of our people. And these stories are the stories that will, when someone 100 years from now, 2 years, 200 years from now, they look back and see, you know, the Vietnamese people of during this time period or Asians during this time period, it's going to be through these stories, you know, right? It's going to be through our collective art. And that's why storytelling has such a, I always like to say storytelling instead of just filmmaking, because it penetrates people a little bit more, you know, it helps them understand what this means more, you know, because when people say, we say film, people, oh, they think entertainment, they think, you know, all that, you know, other stuff, but the filmmaking is more than just entertaining us. It you know, it can teach us, educate us, it can represent us in so many different, in important ways. And so we, you know, the work I'm trying to do is try to create more representation of these stories and try to help, you know, foster in the next generation of storytellers and filmmakers. That was a very long answer. There's many different parts because, you know, it's kind of a big question you asked. And then to answer the last part where you're asking by criterion. So I've been very, you know, it's a big honor to be asked to curate this program. Lisa Ma was the head of programming at Criterion. I met her at the Udine Film Festival. We got into a conversation about it, and she, you know, I told her what I teach at Columbia, and she thought it was really fascinating. And she was like, oh, well, you know, and then let's put together a program to commemorate the 50th anniversary, where basically we're going to do a Criterion, what I'm doing in my class, where we're, so I'm going to curate basically six or seven American films and have them be part of a program alongside six or seven Vietnamese films. And I'm going to do it by theme as well. So one's going to be like soldiers on the battlefield. One's going to be women in war. One's going to be on the home front, morality in war. So different themes, and then see how American films, you know, dealt with these themes, and then how Vietnamese films dealt with these themes. And sometimes they're similar, right? Because the human experience is often very similar. But because depending on which side you're on, the reasons why each side went into the war was different. The way the different countries and filmmakers handle the themes are vastly different. And that's unique to talk about. So I'm basically taking what I do at Columbia in my class and putting it onto Criterion. And hopefully a lot of people will get to see the Vietnamese side, the Vietnamese perspective of the war. And in a way, you know, it's going to be alongside really famous films like Full Metal Jacket, Platoon, and stuff like that, which is, you know, which hasn't been done before. And I'm excited by it. We're going to do conversations and lead-ins to, you know, give context. So we're not just dumping the films on the Criterion, but we're going to give some context of why these films are chosen.
Right.
And the impact and what these themes mean. And so it's going to be released in April and play for several months on the Criterion channel as part of this commemoration.
It's fantastic. And again, like when you say the Vietnamese films, these are Vietnamese films made in Vietnam, right? So
exactly.
Yeah. So that's very, very important. That's very key.
And we're going back to like the 60s and 70s during the wartime. And some of these films, you know, I'm not choosing these films because they're like the best made films in the world and like that. Look, it's not that. It's Vietnamese industry at the time, you know, it was obviously very underdeveloped. And a lot of these films, obviously, you know, films, I say this to my students all the time, and I prep them to give them context. You know, these films, to make films, especially at that time in celluloid, you know, it's very expensive. So it's for the government to approve, you know, the resources to make these films, there's always, you know, a hint of propaganda in there. But that's interesting to me, right?
It's no different from like Top Gun or Rambo being propaganda. You know, so
I teach Rambo in my class. So, and why we went from Deer Hunter to Coming Home to Apocalypse Now to Rambo to Platoon. You know, there's different reasons why that happened in America, and there's different reasons why these films in Vietnam were made to serve different purposes, different time periods. So that's interesting to unpack as well. But the most important thing is that we get the perspective and the point of view of people who are normally overlooked, at least in the Western America, right? The point of view of the Vietnamese in this conflict are rarely seen and heard in America, especially from the point of view of filmmaking and storytelling. So I'm excited about this project.
I'm excited about this too. So it's going to be on the Criterion channel in April, right? So that's, you know, apropos to do that, you know, so... Again, you know, Tony, what you're doing is amazing work, and I really appreciate what everything you do. And this is.
I want to add one last thing. Okay, this is important for the work that we're doing at Columbia and Weatherhead. Again, because I'm a storyteller, filmmaker, it's incredibly important to me. And you know, I am obviously here at Columbia right now. And what I've witnessed is just the, even though we've come a long way and there's a lot more filmmakers in Vietnam and or Vietnamese Americans here, and we're telling our stories, you know, we still have, the road is still long. We have a lot more work to do. And one of the things we're trying to do here at the Weatherhead and while I'm here at Columbia is to try to get more Vietnamese stories told, get more Vietnamese films made, and bring more attention to the region of Vietnam. Because in terms of filmmaking, Japan, Korea, obviously, China, very dominant. Vietnam, not so much. So what we're trying to do is lift up the storytelling filmmaking of Southeast Asia, and in particular, Vietnam as well. And that's something that we are... investing a lot of time and energy this past year and also this year to try to do that. You know, we did a series of programming, and which you helped me, Anderson, to locate some of these filmmakers across the summertime, where we called, you know, I called it Conversations in Storytelling, Regional Voices, Global Impact, where, you know, I went to Hanoi, I went to Saigon, I went to Singapore, Hong Kong, Beijing, and met with the top filmmakers of each of these regions and of different generations, and spoke to them about, you know, how they saw filmmaking, how they saw their, you know, their place as storytellers and their roles as, you know, in this film, this medium, and their contributions and what they think can be done and needs to be done to bring the regional filmmaking that they're a part of for this next few years. And it was an eye-opening experience because each region is different, different needs and different forces and conflict at play. But what was common about all this was just incredible, deep, important desire to tell the stories and tell their own stories of their own regions. And one of the difficulties that I found is how do you do that to be authentic as possible, but also have an impact beyond just your region, right? You make a film about your region. Of course, you know, people in that region, you know, will see it, understand it, but how do you do it in a way where you can have that personal, you know, authenticity, but still have it play out in the world and have that global impact to make a difference. And that's something that's one of the challenges that we are, and dealing with and trying to do our part to help.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, like Asia's not a monolith. Storytelling is universal. Yeah. And also the tenets of storytelling are universal. That's striking that balance. You know, I think we all have shared experiences that are very, very, you know, are kind of that shorthand that we get it, even though I'm not from that culture, but I get it, you know? So, so that's very powerful. But again, thank you, Tony.
And by the way, storytelling and filmmaking, the arts and soft power, right? We talk about regions and worlds and all these politics, economics, stuff like that. But the arts of soft power is incredibly important. You want to move, you know, and change hearts and minds, the arts. I'm telling you, that's where we need to invest.
Yeah, no. Film is the most powerful medium. So, in all of its like aspects and whatnot. So again, Tony, thank you very much, man.
Thanks, Anderson.
Fount of like a lot of info but like what you're doing is great work, and I'm glad that you're helping shape the minds of the next generation of filmmakers as well. So thanks, man.
Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to seeing your curated work on the Criterion Channel this April.
Thank you. Okay. I'll keep you updated as we go along.
Yes, absolutely. We'll also add links to this conversation on when it's on, you know, if you see on Spotify or on YouTube.
Yeah, perfect.
We'll add a bunch of links as well for people to delve more into what your work and et cetera, et cetera. So thanks again.
Okay.
And then, and we'll see you, audience. We'll see you, or hear you. You'll hear us in the next episode. So thanks very much.
Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
In honor of Military Appreciation Month, Verizon thought of a lot of different ways we could show our appreciation, like rolling out the red carpet, giving you your own personal marching band, or throwing a bumping shindig. At Verizon, we're doing all that in the form of special military offers. That's why, this month only, we're giving military and veteran families a $200 Verizon gift card and a phone on us with a select trade-in and a new line on select unlimited plans. Think of it as our way of flying a squadron of jets overhead while launching fireworks. Now that's what we call a celebration, because we're proud to serve you. Visit your local Verizon store to learn more. $200 Verizon gift card requires smartphone purchase, $799.99 or more with new line on eligible plan. Gift card sent within 8 weeks after receipt of claim. Phone offer requires $799.99 purchase with new smartphone line on unlimited ultimate or postpaid unlimited plus. Minimum plan $80 a month with autopay plus taxes and fees for 36 months. Less $800 trade-in or promo credit applied over 36 months. 0% APR. Trade-in must be from Apple, Google, or Samsung. Trade-in and additional terms apply.